Mr. Poston, let's hear your side of it.
My side of it, yes, sir. Just a second. Typical computer problems here. Okay. May it please the court. My name is, of course, Eric Poston. I'm counsel for the plaintiff appellant, Hannah Robertson, individually, and also on behalf of her 11-year-old sister daughter named Rumor. And she was the author of the essay on LGBTQ rights that Anderson Mills Elementary School in Spartanburg County decided not to publish due to the principal's unilateral decision. And from her remarks, it can be deduced that the support, the essay is 100 words and it's written by an 11-year-old and it's mostly all about treating people equally. But there's one line in there that says people need to treat transgenders and people that dress like women differently. You know, they're no different than us. We need to love them and treat them equally. And
Mr. Poston, this is Judge Thacker. Do you agree that Hazelwood applies to this case?
Hazelwood does not apply to this case.
Why not?
Because the Hazelwood court, when they were, you know, they were looking at school-sponsored events. So, you know, I'll just draw no distinction between that and an in-classroom event because the court does the same.
Okay, well, assuming we think that Hazelwood does apply, how is the restriction on the speech here not serving a valid educational purpose?
So the Hazelwood court says, right, so there has to be no educational purpose to the essay.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry, the censorship has to have no valid, basically there needed to be a legitimate, or a valid educational reason, to censor an essay like this. And the thing about this essay is that the whole design of the essay was that all of her classmates write these open essays that would be sort of, you know, sent into the future. And the idea was write about what you think people in the future should know. And so the entire essay was heard.
Except that it was being published now in the present, and the principal found or felt that it was inappropriate for students in the fourth grade to be reading as part of the publication of all the essays. So could the principal not make that determination?
She shouldn't. She's not the teacher who made the assignment. You know, the whole problem with this case is, first of all, it's political. So we've already made our minds up for the most part. But second of all, it was dismissed so quickly that, you know, there was no discovery, no depositions, no anything. So
can I ask you another question, Mr. Poston? I seem to recall somewhere in the documents that ultimately the principal changed her mind and offered to put both essays, the first one that the student wrote, and then the second one that the student wrote, offered to put both essays in the publication, but the parents declined. Is that the case?
That is. So they violated.
So why isn't this case moot?
Because they violated her constitutional rights, which, you know, I've heard talk about, you know, that what is the value of violating, you know, someone's first, what is the monetary value of violating someone's First Amendment rights? And, you know, people say it's hard to put a number on, but what is for certain is that you can't unviolate the right. I can't, you know, if I had a magazine and, you know, I said, you know, anyone who wants to speak about their favorite kind of tree, and you submitted an article to me about your favorite kind of tree, and I know this is a little bit ridiculous, but, and I denied it.
My favorite what? An article about what?
Your favorite tree. Or
favorite tree.
Or I'm trying to plant, right. And because it's easier to explain it this way than through the interest than through the case subject matter. But once I look at your article, I say, well, you know, I hate that plant. For whatever reason, I just really don't, you know, it reminds me of my deceased mother, whatever reason. And I refuse to publish it. And then I get sued. And then I say, okay, I'll publish it. If that's
Mr. Poston, how far does your rationale go? And there's a particular line from Hazelwood that strikes me as relevant. It says, the court says, a school must retain the authority to refuse to sponsor student speech that might reasonably be perceived to advocate drug or alcohol use, irresponsible sex, or conduct otherwise inconsistent with the shared values of a civilized social order. And if every time a teacher says that a discussion of a particular topic is simply age inappropriate, and it's important here that this is a fourth grade class we're talking about, if any time a teacher decides that a particular discussion is just not appropriate or out of bounds, and all of it is done within the context of the curriculum, and the student and the parents are going to haul the teacher into court in a suit for damages, it seems to me to undermine the teacher's authority quite substantially. And, you know, sometimes the ground rules for essay contests and debates and other things, they can appear to be arbitrary or they can appear to be strict. But that's, you know, that's just the way sometimes you have lenient teachers. And then probably the best teacher I ever had was one of the best was a first grade teacher who laid down some strict rules. And if I violated those rules, my parents wouldn't land on the teacher. They'd go after me. And
I'm sorry. I missed the last probably 30 seconds of what you said. My volume cut off.
I was just saying that one of the best teachers I've had laid down strict rules, and it's inconceivable to me that if I or any other student had violated those rules, we'd be given demerits. But I wouldn't feel like I had the opportunity to just drag the teacher into court.
I'm not dragging the teacher into court. She's not being sued. She's going to be one of our witnesses. And as it concerns how things used to be, I would just say, there's no way on God's earth I can convey to y'all what the world is like for an 11-year-old right now. But
is she, I thought she was 10-year-old when she wrote this.
Right, 10, she's 11 now.
Yeah. At this particular time, those distinctions are somewhat material because I don't know when young people gain their sexuality or notions of their own sexuality to be able to respond to issues like this. But 11-year-olds and 12-year-olds in terms of women might be. The question is, it's not clear that at that early age that discussing sexuality and subjects of sexuality and gender are appropriate when the students haven't even identified their own or experienced their own. And so they leave that subject off the table at that point. It's not an illegitimate subject. I think it's a maturity question that they were worried about. And I thought that the Supreme Court in Hazelwood recognized that regulating on the basis of some level of maturity is an appropriate thing for a school to do, as is true with the parents.
Then what's the point of what we're doing right now? If the teacher can do whatever they want, and the principal,
I didn't suggest they can do whatever they want, because we have a lot of principles and we're trying to delineate those principles here. But the question is whether the school indicating that the subject matter did not fit the maturity level of the class. And I think that's really the bottom line. The question was, should a court say they're wrong?
Yes. With all due respect, I'm sure you've read the essay. It's all about not hurting other people and not judging people for things they do.
Well, that's clear. That student probably intended that.
Because the
student wrote a bullying paper as the second one. But the question is, if you have someone who says, be kind to all these people, and then another student says, these people don't deserve to be kind. All of a sudden, you got a class discussion on sexuality, and the kids are all 10 years old. It's a and the teacher says, hold it, we're not going to get in this discussion.
Why not teach a 10-year-old? The thing I don't understand is, these 10-year-olds are seeing everything they want to see on their phone. I don't know many 10-year-olds, but I at least know this young girl, Rumor. And it's not the teacher, if you look at the quotes, the teacher didn't like the viewpoint. There's nothing sexual.
Well, listen, Mr. Poston, look, the thing is, I may or may not actually agree with the student's viewpoint, but the question is whether the principal is able to make a decision that she believes is best and most age appropriate for the entire class.
I would say the teacher should do that with the supervision of the principal. But again, I really think we're just sort of circling around the basic idea of when do we teach kids that there are people that identify as transgender? When do we teach kids about things they don't know, so that they don't freak out when they see it?
Well, and none of us in this argument are educators. We are all lawyers and judges. So don't you think it's best left to the educators to make this decision?
I do. I'm
okay definitely, then.
I think it's best left up to them to a limit, because you got to understand what the heck was the purpose of me going to law school for 3 years if I
don't know
if I can't interpret the law better than the teacher can. See what I'm saying? I believe in giving the teacher as much free range as possible And if you have to have the administration peeking over the shoulder of the teacher, then that's okay. But it's the teacher's classroom. It's the teacher's curriculum. Well, I mean, at least the school I went to, it was just the same curriculum every year with the different teachers. But you understand, I mean, I hope you understand what we need to figure out, or what y'all, I mean, not we, I have no say in this, but
at all right, do you have anything further, Mr. Poston?
What's that?
Do you have anything further? I think your time has expired.
Oh, I don't. I apologize.
Okay. You have some rebuttal time. And Ms. Drain, we'll hear from you.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Jasmine Drain, and I'm appearing today in connection with Tom Barlow, co-counsel. We're representing the defendants appellees, Spartanburg School District 6, and Principal Beth Foster. And it's a pleasure and privilege to have the opportunity to appear before the panel this morning. It is our position that under Hazelwood, the appellants have not and simply cannot state a violation of the First Amendment. And if it pleases the court and acceptable to the court, I will address the core First Amendment issues and defer the remainder of our time for Mr. Barlow to address issues related to qualified immunity and the sua sponte dismissal of the claim against the school district. Hazelwood clearly governs the analysis of the speech at issue in this case. And up until this morning, my understanding that the appellants did not dispute that, but appellants have not provided any authority as to why this court should depart from the Hazelwood analysis. Under Hazelwood, a school has the authority to exercise control over the content and style of student speech in school-sponsored expressive activities that bear the imprimatur of the school, as long as they're reasonably related to a legitimate pedagogical interest. And that's what we're dealing with here. I don't think it can be disputed that a compilation of essays that were part of a written classroom assignment and published in a classroom book constitutes school-sponsored speech. I don't think that issue can be disputed. Also, I think that the record is clear that the principal's actions were clearly related to a legitimate pedagogical interest. If you look, stated in the amended complaint, and I believe on page 17 of the record, the concern was she did not think that the topic was appropriate. The question was raised, at what time do we think it's appropriate for students to be, or for discussions of sexuality to occur in the classroom? And I think the court has addressed that by taking the consistent view that the education of the nation's youth is the primary responsibility of teachers, parents, and local and state school officials, not that of federal judges. And I think because of that, there has been great deference given to administrators' stated pedagogical interests and concerns. I think the Hazelwood Court gives us very clear guidance that schools need to be able to account for the emotional maturity level of the intended audience when they're determining what type of school-sponsored speech should be given on potentially sensitive topics. Schools have to be able to ensure that readers are not exposed to inappropriate material that might not be suitable for their age or their level of maturity. And then courts have even held that sometimes a school's desire to simply avoid controversial or potentially controversial topics within the school community, or a need to dissociate itself with giving the impression that it's sponsoring certain speech, satisfies a legitimate pedagogical interest or concern. And again, that's exactly what we have here. The amended complaint, as alleged by the appellants, states that the principal told the student's teacher that she reviewed the essays and that the student's essay would not be published because the topic was not appropriate. The principal clearly had the authority to condition, you know, which essays or topics were appropriate for fourth grade consumption. And that's why we believe that the district court correctly concluded that there was not a violation of the students' First Amendment rights in any way. You know, to the extent that there's an argument about there being some type of violation based on viewpoint discrimination, it's our position that the district court correctly concluded that Hazelwood does not require viewpoint neutrality. But even if it did, absent from the complaint or any allegations to suggest that the principal's decision was made on a viewpoint, the allegations that are alleged, which are expressly denied, generally they relate to topic. There's no allegations that support that the principal disagreed with the student's position that she had placed in the essay. There's no allegations supporting the principal's view. And I think most importantly, there's no allegations to support that the principal allowed other students to submit topics or write essays concerning sexuality or the LGBTQ community, which had an opposite view. That would be a showing of discrimination based on viewpoint, and we simply do not have that in this case. And so for those reasons, we believe that the district court's ruling should be affirmed in terms of its decision that there are simply, the plaintiffs cannot state a violation of the First Amendment. And if the court has any questions regarding First Amendment, I'll be glad to address those at this time. Otherwise, I would like to defer the remainder of our time for Mr. Barlow to address issues pertaining to qualified immunity and the sua sponte dismissal of the claim against the school district.
All right. If my colleagues have no further questions of you at this time, I'll ask Mr. Barlow to come forward.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Tom Barlow, also representing Ms. Foster and Spartanburg School District 6. I think as far as the qualified immunity, second prong of the qualified immunity test under Pearson v. Callahan, I think my co-counsel has already said that the law is clearly settled, but it's clearly settled in our favor in this case under Hazelwood. At a bare minimum, framing the issue properly, should an elementary school principal in 2019, given a split of circuit court authority on the issue and no applicable opinion by the Supreme Court, this court, or even any South Carolina district court, have known that temporarily excluding an essay addressing LGBTQ issues from a fourth grade class publication would violate students' First Amendment rights? And I think the answer is an obvious no to that question. So at a bare minimum, the judge should be affirmed on the qualified immunity second prong of the Pearson v. Callahan test in favor of Ms. Foster. I'll move on to the arguments that were raised in appellant's brief on the district court judge's sua sponte dismissal of the claim against Spartanburg School District 6, as well as Ms. Foster. The only citation to authority that appellants rely on in their brief are Rule 41 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. That is the only basis for a federal court, district court judge to dismiss a complaint on its own motion or sua sponte. And clearly that's not the case. Other rules permit district courts to dismiss actions upon their own motion. We cited in our brief Wright and Miller Federal Practice and Procedure, recognizing that courts can do that under both Rule 12 and Rule 56. And other citations that we have are to cases where sua sponte dismissals were appropriate under 12b6. If the reason for the dismissal of claims against other parties would lead to the same outcome as a motion made by a non-moving defendant would have the same outcome as under the underlying basis of the decision on a moving defendant. And the purpose of that obviously is judicial economy and efficiency. You know, if the law is already settled as to one defendant, there's no reason to make the other defendants file a Rule 12C motion or file their own motion to dismiss if it's a foregone conclusion. And the courts apply that, provided that there's not any prejudice to the plaintiff from that ruling. And we submit that there's no prejudice to appellant here at all. Had a full chance to argue the merits as part of the first prong of the Pearson v. Callahan qualified immunity analysis. They certainly had notice that we were moving to dismiss the claim on the merits of the First Amendment claim. While the motion to dismiss was pending, a second amended complaint was filed that, with full knowledge that we were challenging the merits of the First Amendment claim. The Second Amendment claim only addressed a state court claim of negligent infliction of emotional distress. So a full opportunity to brief both prongs of the Callahan test. They've made no arguments in the brief, only a cursory Rule 41 argument. The basic legal principle here is the same as to the school district as it was to Ms. Foster. If there's no First Amendment case on the merits against Ms. Foster, there's not one against the school district for the same reasons. And the district court.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Barlow.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Poston, do you have some comments in rebuttal?
You're muted, Mr. Poston.
Mr. Poston?
Can you hear me?
Do you have some comments you wish to offer in rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll first address Mr. Barlow on the qualified immunity issue, the sua sponte dismissal of the claim against the district. The claim against the district is different than the claim against the principal because our argument, of course, is that this, Principal Foster doesn't get qualified immunity because she is violating what, has been so far, called clearly established First Amendment rights, constitutional rights, which sounds like a very high barrier, but in all honesty, the Supreme Court says the contours of the right have to be sufficiently clear that a reasonable official, i.e. the principal, would have to know what she's doing is unlawful. And basically, that's the situation we have. It's not the same argument. It's the district as an entity is going and alleging violations of the First Amendment. And we're saying that, Principal Foster behaved in a way to where he should not get the protections of qualified immunity. And one thing, and I know I just despise how in South Carolina this qualified immunity law basically it bars and throws out everything in a similar way as the Hazelwood case that they were talking about later. I keep hearing misinterpretations and with all due respect to opposing counsel, I know y'all are intelligent, much more experienced than me. And you know that you're taking case law and you're sort of manipulating it in your favor, and that's what we do. But
what?
For instance, as it goes to what I claimed, the principle.
I wouldn't say that opposing counsel is manipulating anything in their favor. You might say that they are arguing the case law in their favor, and you can do the same, but I don't think you should accuse them of manipulating anything.
Well, I'm looking at the 12th paragraph of the amended complaint, and I have a couple quotes here from Principal Foster saying, basically, look, this paper is going to make other parents upset. It's not acceptable, and it would create an undesirable situation at the school. That's three quotes of the four. The fourth one is, she said, it's not age appropriate to discuss transgenders, lesbians, and drag queens outside of the home. So, I mean, I could, define manipulate however you want to. You know, I feel like there's, and then when we look at Hazelwood, it's another catch-all. I mean, that's the problem when you have a case like this. There's, you can make any decision you want to based on Hazelwood. Because, yes, Hazelwood said, you know, the censorship has to be reasonably related to legitimate educational concerns. But then they go on, and as usual, I wish the opinion was more clear, but it does say basically that, you know, the Supreme Court, in terms of their concerns, they listed some. They said they want school officials to have the right to censor materials, things that are ungrammatical, poorly written, inadequately researched, biased, prejudiced, vulgar, or profane. And then the very last one, it says, or unsuitable for immature audiences, which from what I could tell has not been defined. An 18-year-old could be immature. They all are, pretty much. You know, an 11-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 14-year-old. And I just think that, I mean, looking really, you've got, you know, they list the reasons and only the very last one. Did they, and we know that this, or unsuitable for immature audiences, that's the catch-all. That's how, if I were on the other side, I would say that would be the catch-all. Because there's no way that I could sit here and define what the court means by immature audiences. And so basically, the court can just say, as the district.
Do you think a 10-year-old is immature?
I think everybody's immature.
Hey, Mr. Poston, I think we've been over this, and I think we appreciate and understand your point. All right?
All right, thank you, Judge.
All right, thank you. I'm going to ask our courtroom deputy if she will adjourn court.
This honorable court stands adjourned until this afternoon. God save the United States and this honorable court.